Welcome to It's All Journalism. I'm Michael O'Connell, and I'm here today with Megan Clougherty.
Hello.
I met today's guest, Maura Judkiss, last summer when I pitched an interactive arts project to the Washington Post. An editor introduced us. While the project never took off, I was really impressed with Maura's enthusiasm for covering the arts scene in D.C., so I knew that sooner or later I wanted to ask her to be a guest on our podcast. How are you doing, Maura?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, good. Well, first things first. You were part of a pretty big story recently around a photo your father took years ago of Mr. Rogers, and it went viral, and you ended up on PBS NewsHour even. Could you sort of talk about what happened with that?
Yeah, it was so strange how it all happened, actually, because, you know, I cover these things that go viral all the time, and I never really thought I would be part of one of them. The shootings in Connecticut were very terrible, obviously. And that day, people were starting to spread around these quotes and different things on Facebook, as people do when these tragedies happen. And someone shared something that was in my Facebook newsfeed, and it was a photo of Mr. Rogers touching a little boy's face with a quote from Mr. Rogers about how to teach children about violence, saying, look for the helpers. The people who are helping on TV are how to teach kids about violence and how not to be so afraid when terrible news happens. And I looked at it, and I knew it was my father's photo. So my father, he's been a photographer his whole life, and he has worked with Mr. Rogers since the early 80s. It was actually the first photo he had ever taken. And since then, he's done books with him, and he sort of had this friendship and affiliation with Mr. Rogers' company, too. A lot of photos of Mr. Rogers out there were taken by my dad, but this one was kind of a particularly special one, not only because it was his first one, but just because it's very, very candid. A lot of the other photos that he took were staged for books and other things. So I saw this, and I'm like, that's my dad's picture. And it was in my Facebook newsfeed, and it had been shared by this group called 170 Million Americans for Public Broadcasting. And by the time I saw it, which was about Friday night, it had been shared by, I think, about 60,000 people by then. Wow. So I was like, oh, well, this is really taking off. So I called my dad, and first I wanted to make sure that it was his photo, because there are other people who have taken pictures of Mr. Rogers before I said anything, of course. So I called him, and I'm like, that photo of the little boy, that's your picture, right? And he's like, oh, yeah, what about it? And I was like, well, did you know that, you know, thousands and thousands of people are reading it and seeing it online? He's like, what do you mean? Because my dad is not really a Facebook user. He has a Facebook profile, but he doesn't, like, really understand what going viral means. So I sort of explained it to him, and I was like, kind of at that point, a little bummed that he wasn't getting credit, because it was going viral, and it's such a wonderful photo. And my first impulse was like, oh, I'm gonna contact this group and like see if they'll just add my dad's name to the photo so that like people will know it's his. And I was really glad that it was being shared so much, but I also just sort of wanted him to have that. And it was the weekend, so they didn't get back to me. And then I told a few friends about it, and then one of my friends saw it on Meet the Press. They closed out Meet the Press on Sunday with the photo. And at that point, I was like, oh, well, this is really something. I should actually just take control of this myself and just write about it. So the next day I pitched it to one of the editors at the Post, and I was like, oh, this is my dad's picture. By then it had been shared by almost 90,000 people, and it had been going on all these other sites too. So they were like, yeah, you should definitely write about that. I wrote a blog post. I interviewed my dad. And the thing that impressed me so much about my dad too is, you know, he's a photographer. I don't think he's really been interviewed very much, but he came up with such wonderful quotes. It was really nice to interview my own dad for the first time ever. And he had this great quote about how like Mr. Rogers and this little boy are looking each other in the eye. And my dad said that it was like seeing the face of God was how this little boy felt when he was looking at Mr. Rogers. And I was like, Dad, that's so wonderful. You did a really good job. So I read about that. It was in the style section. And after that, it sort of like really blew up, because I think people, when they see those images that go viral, mm-hmm. they don't really ever know where they come from. And so it was nice to provide that explanation. And then I got to go and Meet the Press, which was really fun. Or sorry, I went on PBS. Sorry, Meet the Press was the day before. It also ended up on MSNBC and the Today Show and a few other places.
Wow, that's
so
incredible.
It was really cool. But then the missing piece of that puzzle too was that my dad never knew the name of the boy or like anyone in the room. It was just kind of this quick photo op where Mr. Rogers showed up. My dad was there. He took some photos and then they left, and he never like found out any information about anyone there. And so I had hoped by giving this a little bit of publicity that the family of that boy would come forward, because we never really learned what happened to that boy. And 2 weeks later, they actually did. So I wrote an update. It was a sad story, but also a happy story. The boy, he was adopted by a family. He had a lot of problems, but they weren't insurmountable problems. He was hydroencephalic, which meant that there was fluid on his brain, so he had some motor skill problems. But he ended up being adopted by this family and living like a pretty happy childhood. And he ended up working as a volunteer firefighter, not actually fighting fires, but in the office. And he was doing great. But then, unfortunately, he died in a bicycle accident last year. Aww. So his mother found me and told me the whole story. So I ended up writing a little obituary for him. And so it was kind of nice to have that update as well, so that everyone could really find out the whole story of everything behind this photo.
Wow, it's sort of an amazing how something like that could happen. Now, how do you feel as a journalist, you know, having something, well, you didn't really, outside of, once you noticed it and you wrote a story about it, this wasn't really something that you were a part of, but suddenly became a part of, you're sort of sucked in as the thing went viral.
Yeah, I did sort of become a part of it, because people, I mean, you know, when I went on PBS, they didn't talk to my dad, they talked to me instead. I mean, partly that was just because I was here and so are they, and mm-hmm. my dad's in Pittsburgh. But it did end up becoming sort of my story as well. And that was fascinating, I thought. It was also just really nice to be able to have this kind of tribute to my dad, too. Mm-hmm. As a journalist, we don't really, you know, we don't get to write about our families that much, and not that we should write about our families all the time, but it was kind of the right moment to like do something really nice for my family too, because they were really pleased to see how it all turned out. Of course, it came from such a terrible tragedy, and we were sort of glad that if all the things that people could look to like have a kind of like a moment of light in this really dark day during Newtown, it was something that my dad had made, so that was pretty cool.
Tell us a little bit about your career background and how you ended up finding arts as your specialty.
Oh, sure. So, well, my parents are artists. My dad's a photographer, obviously, and my mom is an artist as well. She's an abstract painter. So I sort of just always grew up with art in my household. My grandmother was also a painter, and I kind of grew up in museums, too, because my mom taught art at the Carnegie Museum of Art in Pittsburgh. And so I would like go to class with her when she was little, and she taught all kinds of art history subjects, and she also taught painting. And so it was just something that I always had growing up. And it just sort of felt like a natural thing for me to want to write about, because it's where my experience has been. So I got into journalism in high school through television, actually. We had a great TV channel in my high school and wonderful teachers for that. But my high school TV teacher, like on the last day of school, you know, I thought I was going to go to journalism school and go on television and be in television and be a producer or something. And he pulled me aside and he's like, you know, what you really should do when you go to college is the first day of school, you should go to the school newspaper and ask them for a job writing. You should really be a writer. And I was like, oh, okay, sure, I'll try that too. So I went to GW, George Washington University, and I did what he said, like maybe the second day of school. I went to the newspaper office and I asked to cover something, and they're like, well, what do you like? And I said, arts, because that's what most of my experience had been in at that point. And so they sent me to a Guster concert, I believe. This was like 2003. This was 2003. And that was the first thing I ever wrote for the GW Hatchet. And I ended up becoming the contributing arts editor the year after that, and then the arts editor the year after that. And sort of wanting to do some stuff other than just college journalism, I started freelancing for The Examiner here when that first started up, and writing some art stories for them, and freelancing for like a few other places. And then I saw this job opening for an internship at the Washington Post, then called City Guide, now called the Going Out Guide, which is where I work currently. But I applied for this internship, and it was an unpaid internship, but this was 2005, and I had also been working other part-time jobs for real money, not for free, and they offered me this internship, and, you know, this was, like, such a different time when you could get away with something this cocky, but I was like, well, I really can't afford to work for free, so maybe you could give me a part-time job instead, and they were like, okay, we can do that. That would never happen now. I'm pretty sure it would never happen. But I was really fortunate to have been looking for jobs at that time. So I got a part-time job as an assistant producer for the City Guide, and that involved like going through all the listings and inputting listings and helping out with the blog and a few other things and kind of like web testing, because they were actually transforming the site a lot at that point. This was when Washington Post was still in two separate buildings also. And that was where I kind of got all of my web experience from, because at that point they weren't teaching as much of that at GW too. I mean, now I think they've totally transformed the journalism program a lot. But at that point, I learned it all on the job, and I'm really grateful for that, too, because it's how I was able to get all of my subsequent jobs, was from that kind of on-the-job training. And so I was part-time for 2 years there while I was in school, and also freelancing for Express and City Paper and a few other places. And they couldn't offer me a full-time job right after graduation, so I ended up going to U.S. News and World Report and working as a producer there for the money and business section for about 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. And that was cool, too, because that was a very different type of experience. And I was there during this really interesting time in U.S. News and World Report's history, because we had gone from a weekly to being every other week to being monthly. And then right after I left, they seized publication. So, yeah, so it was like very, very tumultuous time there. And I got to be kind of, it was a really sad time too, because a lot of people got laid off while I was there. But now everything seems to be pretty stable there. And so then while I was at U.S. News and World Report, I had still maintained some ties with the Washington Post, because I actually sat really close to Jim Brady. I think you've had him on the show too.
Right.
Yeah. And so Jim and I knew each other. And then I had heard about the new thing that he was starting up at the time, which was TBD.com. And so I think I kind of like ambushed him at an event that he was speaking at.
I think he gets ambushed quite a lot.
I mean, I think I'm not the only person who did it, but I was like, I really want to be a part of what you're doing. I'm sure 10 million people were saying that to him at the same time.
Gave your job to get you away from him.
Yeah. And then I had been freelancing for City Paper a lot. I'd been doing a lot of freelancing for City Paper pretty much every week. I'd been writing art reviews and feature stories for them too. And then my editor at City Paper, Andrew Bojan, ended up getting hired by TBD too. And I was like, all right, now I really need to be a part of this thing. Mm-hmm. Two of my favorite people that I've worked with are in charge. So I talked to both of them. I ended up going over to TBD in June before it launched. And that was a dream job. It was really, really fun while it lasted.
Yeah, we just had Mandy Jenkins in, and she said it was like the freaks and geeks
of
journalism.
That's a wonderful description. Mandy's the best, yeah.
13 weeks, and you're moving on. Everybody moves on to something bigger and better. So how did you end up at the Post, at your current job?
Yeah, well, so I was with TBD for a while, and I was covering theater and visual art and culture for TBD, and having a really, really good time. But then, as everyone knows, things started to fall apart. And I was not one of the people who was let go in February. Unfortunately, a lot of my coworkers were let go then. But I think for all of us who were left, the writing was sort of on the wall. So everyone was looking. And I knew a lot of people at the Post at this point, too. Peter Marks, who is the theater critic there, mm-hmm. he kind of gave me a hand. He is someone I had known from GW also, because he used to teach there. And so he started sending me job openings, and there was a producer opening. And so I applied for that, and that's how I ended up at the Post. So between TBD and the Post, I did a fellowship at the University of Southern California. It was part of the National Endowment for the Arts, and mm-hmm. it was an arts fellowship, and it was really, really cool. It was 2 weeks in California, and it was pretty intensive on theater and social media and a lot of other things. And so that was a really good break in between the two jobs. And then I started the Post as a producer for the style section and did that for about a year and a half. And then just recently, 2 months ago, switched over as a reporter for the weekend section.
Oh, and what does that beat entail?
All kinds of stuff. Really, basically just all of the fun stuff that any reporter would get to do. It's really a dream job. I'm having such a good time. I cover theater and art and now food, too. So I'm going out to eat for work, which is like something that I'm still getting used to. It really is. It's been a really good time. So we blog a lot. We have the Going Out Guide blog, and we usually write about 2 posts per person per day for that. And that can be anything from arts happenings to restaurant reviews or, I'm not a restaurant critic and I'm not a theater critic. The things that the weekend section's role is more previews than reviews because, the critics all work for the style section. So like if a restaurant opens, I or one of my coworkers will be one of the first people to go check it out. But then later, Tom Sietsma will be the person who writes the official review. So we kind of like get people excited about things, I guess.
You may interview the chef or
something
to do a feature.
Interview the chef or the designer or anyone
newsy.
Newsy, so it's definitely more newsy for sure. And it's definitely things that happen in advance too. So like if a show is opening this weekend, I will not have seen it yet, but I'll have interviewed the costume designer or the director.
How does social media or what role does social media play in your job?
Oh, definitely. I get so many stories from social media. A good example, I'm actually trying to solve this mystery that I found out about a few days ago. I saw it on Reddit. I kind of troll Reddit a little bit. And this woman had posted, I ended up writing about this. This woman had posted that in the 1980s, her mother had painted a painting of this breakdancing instructor that she took breakdancing lessons with in like 1983. And she only knew him by the name of California. And she's trying to find him to give him this painting that her mother made of him, but she has no information other than the fact that his name is California. And I was like, that's a great story. I want to find this California. Because actually, it kind of relates back to this this cover story I had written for City Paper like 3 years ago where I found this lost painting for a show at the Katzen University. That was a really weird thing, too. It took a while because when it comes to finding paintings or finding people connected with paintings, there's no electronic records. You just kind of have to find people who knew that person and call them. Mm-hmm. So it took a long time to track down this other painting, which is a fabulous painting, by the way. It's this painting of Washington under this atomic bomb mushroom cloud. It was painted, like, I think, I don't know, in 1977 or 78.
It's a political statement.
Yeah. And so that painting, it took me a long time to track it down. And for the City Paper story, I didn't end up finding it until like 3 days before my deadline, too. So I was not even sure it was going to happen. But it ended up finding it in this guy's house. And I wanted to go see it because I was like, wow, we finally found this painting after calling 10,000 people. Not really, but a lot of people after all of these months. And he's like, no, I really can't have you come see it. And I was like, I just want to look at the painting. I'm not going to disturb you. I just want to make sure it's there. And he's like, well... And eventually it came out that he was actually a hoarder and that the painting was buried under all of his stuff. And so like with the City Paper and the gallery that wanted to show it, we ended up hiring some art movers to come in and like extract it from his house. But anyway, that's sort of a side story. Because I had found that other painting for City Paper, now I'm kind of on the hunt for the person with this painting. And it's kind of different because now I have the painting, but I need to find the person. So that's something I pulled off of social media recently. But also all kinds of blog posts and events that we didn't know about. There are so many events in the city. Mm-hmm. And at the Going Out Guide, we have to just be on top of all of them because we want to have this really complete listing and database of like anything a person could possibly do in any given night. So we're always on the hunt through Facebook and through Twitter and all the time to find new events.
Do you guys feel like you're in competition with other types of blogs and services, things like Yelp, where people will do reviews and things or that are out there that that the Post is trying to, I don't want to say catch up, but that's, that they've got to, you know, address that sort of area of social media?
I mean, with Yelp, it's tricky because, I mean, I personally do not like Yelp because I feel like everyone who reviews things on Yelp has sort of, they're kind of, it's all about like, I am writing a review on Yelp and not like I am trying to give you an experience that I had. Like usually it's reviews on, I mean, people make fun of reviews on Yelp all the time because I'm sure you've seen that one blog where it's a little bit like my boyfriend and I, and you know, it's really about them trying to make themselves heard rather than give you an accurate experience. And I think we are a little more objective, but at the same time, I totally recognize that there are so many other places that people can get entertainment news from and can get reviews of new venues from. And I realized that you know, people could go to those places instead of us. And also that, you know, the role of a critic is just so different these days than it used to be, because now everyone can be a critic. Obviously, Yelp is the best example of that. But I mean, on any blog or any site, people can be a critic, and it does diminish the role of a critic. And I kind of think that's okay, too, because I also think that when it comes to arts criticism, you know, a critic can say whatever they want, but people are more likely to get those kinds, to get their, how to say this, people are going to think what they think about a movie or a piece of art or whatever, because they might not look to that critic's opinion, and they will look to their friends instead. And I think that's something that journalism has to adapt to, really, is that the critic is no longer this voice that is
omniscient.
Exactly. Yeah.
We were talking about this on another podcast about actually, it was about the election, but about how people use. They were talking about how the role that Facebook played in the election, and the fact that a lot of people rely on, you know, the opinions of their friends, that has so much weight. Mm-hmm. And so, do you find yourself sort of competing even against that? How are you trying to tap into that?
This is something that we talked about in my arts journalism fellowship a lot, actually, is like, what role will the critic have in the next 10 years? And I think that the role of the critic is definitely diminishing. I mean, also partly because many newspapers can't afford to have critics anymore, too. Mm-hmm. So that necessarily will diminish their role. But I also think one thing that we talked about in my fellowship that is something that I try and practice all the time in the stories that I write is that sort of a way, you know, people are going to think what they think about a movie. You know, if they want to see some movie that has Adam Sandler in it and they think it's like the best movie ever, they're going to think that. And, you know, nothing a critic is going to say will change their mind. But I also feel like one thing that journalists can provide that, like, your average internet critic who's just some guy who had seen that movie, who does not have the access of a journalist, what we can do is we can provide more of a behind the scenes kind of look. That's something that people who are writing on Yelp don't get. You know, they don't get to talk to the chef. They don't get to see the dish being plated. They don't get to find out how this work of art was made. All they have is the finished product. But journalists have access to the entire thing. And so I think that that is kind of the way that arts journalism could move in the next however many years, because I think that that's the way that we'll be able to differentiate ourselves from people who are writing on Yelp or who have their own blog. Mm. And that's something that I try and do. That's something I experimented with a lot at TBD, and it's something that I'm trying to do currently, too, in my job. Like, so for TBD, I did this one series about this play called One Flea Spare, and it was put on by the Forum Theater here in D.C., and they were very generous, and they gave me access to the entire production from like the first table read to the very end. And so I actually came and I sat in on everything that they were doing. And it was very educational for me, just as someone who had never had that kind of access to see what that was like. But I also think that most people who go to the theater, who see a movie, they don't necessarily know all the work that goes into it, too. So I ended up writing this series. It ended up being maybe 10 posts or so, kind of just walking people through how this play was made. And the play ended up not getting very good reviews, too. And that was fine, I thought, because it was, for me, more about just showing people what went into this. And whether or not it was going to get good reviews didn't matter, because some people still really loved it, and Peter Marks didn't end up liking it, but that's Peter Marks. So, you know, every critic, it's their own opinion, but people who see the play still might end up really loving it and wanting to know what went into it.
Do you think, as an arts reporter, I mean, obviously you have a team and you have people who specialize in different, you know, in theater or in music or
visual arts. Yeah,
right. You cover so much
classical music. Yeah.
Do you think? I mean, on a smaller scale, you need to, as an arts reporter, prioritize, make sure that you cover, you know, different forms of art? Or do you think that you kind of have to listen to your audience and say, you know, my audience keeps responding to music and to the latest, you know, exhibit that's coming out, so maybe I don't cover the new restaurant opening? Or do you think that there's sort of a prioritization that goes on as far as the arts world goes in journalism?
Well, so first, the critics, there will always be those critics, and they will always have their specialties, because, I mean, you wouldn't expect Anne Majette to suddenly write about food, or, you know, mm-hmm. like, they should have their specialties. And I think that's the wonderful thing about critics, too, is that they have this huge depth of knowledge that I do not have, for example, because they've been doing this for years. And they have a much more informed opinion than the people who are writing on Yelp or who are writing their own blogs. But I also think it is good to listen to your audience. So with the weekend section, for example, we have found that our audience really, really responds to food stories more than anything else. People love food, especially now that DC is getting this really interesting foodie culture.
Right.
There's so much more to do when it comes to restaurant openings and cool little pop-ups and everything. So we do listen to that, and we are writing a lot more about food, and that's why I've started to do a lot more food stories recently.
Yeah, and people have to eat. The bottom line is everybody likes to eat something tasty, but not everybody goes to a movie or a play or reads a book. So, I mean, it's a common human experience that I think, just at a very basic level.
Did you ever feel like, especially when you were coming up before you got full-time jobs at the Post and at TBD, that you were kind of fighting for what you wanted to cover? Because I know a lot of times, I mean, smaller papers are closing their sports sections, closing their art sections. I mean, it's a harder thing to specialize in. Do you think, I mean, I kind of am looking for more advice for someone who maybe is coming up and is interested in covering art and covering culture.
Yeah, I think, I guess, advice for someone who wants to cover the arts is to be able to cover a lot of different types of arts, because I think there are a lot of people who go into this and they're like, I really want to be a music critic. But, like, there are so many people who want to be music critics. So many people. So it's like, if you can write a little bit of everything, you have a better chance of diversifying your skills and maybe getting a job that might not be a music critic. It might be a producer for the style section, for example, but then you get to write some music reviews, and then you get to write some art reviews and other things. And, like, so for me, I guess I was a little bit lucky in that my kind of area of knowledge was visual art because of my parents and growing up. And there are fewer people who are trying to get into that, but also there are fewer jobs for that too. And so, I mean, if you want to be an arts reporter, you might have to wait a little bit longer, unfortunately.
And freelance, like you said,
and freelance,
kind of make
yeah.
it work, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, so when I was at US News and World Report, we don't cover the arts at US News and World Report. But I sort of actually found ways to fit arts into things that I was writing too. So you know, an education story about arts education, or when I was covering environmental news for them, the film WALL-E came out, and like that ended up getting on our blog. So you can kind of find ways to make other beats a little bit. That you can tailor things to your interests a little bit too.
So how much do your readers sort of play into what you cover? You know, just feedback and your interaction with them.
Well, with the Going Out Guide, actually more than in any job that I have ever had, probably. The Going Out Guide is, there's so much give and take between readers and our staff. I mean, we do a chat every Thursday where we just take questions, where people say, my mother is here, we need to find a brunch, it can't be too expensive. And, you know, and you have to, like, think off the top of your head and be able to give them exactly what they want. So that's a great example of, like, how we're constantly interacting with our readers. But also, and people will send us emails like that too, where they just need to, like, find something and we'll help them out. But also a lot
of our called Google. You should check that out.
But Google might not get you, like, the perfect thing.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. So I mean we try for that. But also also a lot of our stories involve readers too. So we're doing a story coming up. I'm actually not writing this, but one of my coworkers is. And it's something we do every year called, like, the 40 Best Eats in Washington. This is another food example, but people go so crazy for our food stories. So, and it's picking the 40 most essential dishes that everyone should have, whether it's, like, a Ben's Chili Bowl, yeah, half smoke or a whatever, you know. And so that that's like crowdsourced pretty much. I mean, we pick our things. Each of us pick a dish, but then the rest of it comes from readers. And we talk to readers and find out what they think is like the best thing that you should have to eat here.
Do you have an experience of in food of somebody telling you about something and you're just sort of blown away by what it is? Is there any of those experiences?
You mean like in a particular dish that I've tried? Well, I'm pretty new to food, actually.
Oh, okay.
So I've only been doing
art that you... Well, no. Has anybody tipped you off to any art story that you weren't aware of that you suddenly... It was like, wow, this is a really cool thing.
Yeah. Well, so a couple of things that I've been interested in covering art stories. This is another thing that I wrote for TBD, actually. There is this artist named Victoria Gatan, who she's really cool. I had met her through the art scene, and she does these really kind of spooky, sort of eerie portraits, and they're often women who she has the models put like corn syrup in their mouths, and they kind of dribble it out down their front of their body, and it sort of looks like they are bleeding from the mouth a little bit. Yeah, it's not totally accessible to everyone, but you guys are making some really funny faces right now. No, it's okay. So I was really kind of interested in her work, and I think someone told her that I was, and she ended up, and so when you look at her photos, you know, you kind of think, you think about what she's trying to tell you and about sort of the darkness of the photo. But you also, like, on this kind of baser level, you're like, what is it like for that model who has to, like, spit this stuff out of her mouth, you know? And I think someone kind of tipped her off that I was interested, because she ended up asking me to model for one of the photos. And that sort of launched this thing for me where I've become really interested in sort of experiencing artists' work in like the closest way possible. Because there's no way that you can really describe what it's like for those models. You can interview them as much as you want and they'll be able to tell you, but like you won't really know until I had that corn syrup in my mouth and I was dribbling it out and my hair was covered in like all of this other goo. And it was pretty gross. It was actually really
gross. But obviously
gross.
A really like personal experience. I mean, to be
it
able
was
to write
super
that
personal.
Way. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it ended up being a really cool story, and it took a long time for it to come together because I ended up talking to every single one of her models. And they all had totally different things to say, because I was like, did she tell you what she was going for in this? And no one said they did. And they all had their own idea. But then when we sort of put all of our experiences together, we sort of realized that she was acting out this sort of bad dream through each of us. Like we were sort of becoming her like avatar in a way. Huh. And so that was something I never would have learned through just reporting. And that's something I try and keep in mind when I write stories, is that I want to get as close to it as I can. Let's see, some other examples for that with the Post. So I went to Fashion Week this year for the first time. And you know, when you read Fashion Week stories every year, they have their own cliches. It's like, who is sitting in the front next to Anna Wintour? And like, you know, this year the big parties are whatever. And it's like, you don't want to write that kind of story again. So when I went to Fashion Week, I was not interested in those kinds of things. And what sort of emerged during the few days that I was there were that there are so many people on the fringes of Fashion Week who are just like total wannabes who will just hang on to anything they can get. And so it's become really interesting there too with all of these style bloggers and the street style photographers that have emerged. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of this self-feeding ecosystem of like the street style photographers will show up, but they're like, they're not Bill Cunningham, you know, they're not like the street style photographers. They're just people with blogs who are really interested in fashion. And then these style bloggers will show up who are just really pretty girls who have really nice clothing. And they'll show up and the street style photographers will not realize that they are not someone famous, because when you're at Fashion Week, everyone is well dressed and you like anyone could be famous if you don't actually know who they are.
Covering your bases to make
sure. So like they end up getting photographed by these street style photographers and then everyone else thinks that they're famous. But then the girls who are dressed up, they don't necessarily know that the street style photographers who are shooting them are not like famous bloggers either. Right, so it's like this kind of like cycle of like you don't know who's who, neither of them
who's
know who each other is at all. And it was fascinating because you'd watch this happen at every single show, and none of these people had tickets to actually get into the shows too. And you know, I was able to get tickets to go into the show as press, but I ended up not writing about that stuff as much as what was happening on the outside. And then it kind of really cemented the whole experience for me when I was photographed by these people. And it's like, I am nobody. Like, I have never been to Fashion Week before. I am not a fashion person. I just work for the Washington Post, and I was literally wearing pants from the Gap. So they were like red pants. I mean, it was a nice outfit. I don't want to undersell myself
here. You did have to get dressed up.
Yeah, I mean, I tried really hard. I was wearing red pants and this like white silk blouse and like a mint colored blazer. So it was kind of cool colors. And I had like a really nice purse too. But they were like all the nicest things I owned, basically. So this guy, he takes my picture and he's like, so tell me everyone that you're wearing. And I was like, well, his pants are from the Gap. And he's like, and he like kind of rolled his eyes. And then he's like, well, what about your shirt? And I was like, I paused because I was like, I don't want to say that it's from H&M, you know? And then he's like, okay, well, I'll just write that it's vintage. And it just was such an example of how Fashion Week worked to me. So I ended up writing about myself for Fashion Week in the same way sort of that I wrote about Victoria, in that like you understand things a little bit better when you end up being in the story.
Okay? Though, I mean, from a journalism perspective, I know if I was covering obviously very different, but if you're covering a shooting or something, nobody cares about
George Plimpton used to write stories like that.
That's
all the
true.
Time.
I mean, I just think
it's a different type of journalism.
Yeah, it's a different type of journalism.
Yeah.
Do you find yourself drawn to that kind of?
Well, I think the nice thing about arts journalism is that you have so much more flexibility and creativity. Like, you know, I do not have to write in the inverted pyramid style. There's no formula. So as long as there's certainly a line to cross when it comes to like self-promoting. Like, the tone of the story was not, look at me, I was photographed at Fashion Week, because that would be terrible, and I didn't feel that way either. That would be silly. So, you have to have the right tone, and you also, you have to make sure that this is not self-promoting. And I think it was also kind of the same when I ended up writing about my father. Like, the story was not about me, the story was about my father, but I was the only person who could tell his story in that way.
Right.
So I think it's like, that's sort of the litmus test is like, are you the only person who can tell the story in this way? Then it's okay to include yourself in the story. And it's certainly not something, it's something I use very sparingly, of course, too. It's not like
every story is.
No, I'm not a memoirist. No way. No, most stories I write are not like that. But I feel like some of the most interesting stories, I've had that kind of interesting perspective just because it was something that happened to me, mm-hmm. and it was about the arts.
So. How do you feel about the future of arts journalism, not only just in D.C., but, you know, do you see that there's a lot of people still interested in writing about it, interested in reading about it? I mean, where do you see arts journalism going?
I mean, this sort of goes back to what I was saying about critics, too. Like, I think there's definitely an appetite for arts journalism. I think people are always going to be interested. Also, I mean, in entertainment journalism, too, in what they can do this weekend, what the best concert is, what they should see and what they should hear and what they should be experiencing. And culture, just in general. I mean, there are so many people who write cultural essays, and those end up being the things that are the most shared that I see a lot of times. So, and I think it's important that we should always have that. But I also think that that critics need to listen to their audience, and that arts journalists need to listen to their audience, and also provide something that is different. And that's I think that's something that we're all trying to do is have a different voice and not just be a critic, but be someone who can provide something a little bit more
relatable experience, or get somebody to understand what it would be like to be there, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think behind the scenes stories, those have always done really well. People are really interested in like taking things apart piece by piece, I think. So that's something that critics can do that is different. And I think that's the key to arts journalism surviving is listening to our audiences and being different and being interesting, of course.
So you don't think that you're going to be replaced by just a whole series of blogs about people writing about stuff?
I hope not. I don't know. I don't know. I hope
I feel
not.
Like there's a space for them, and there's a space
There's
plenty of room. The internet's
plenty
huge.
Plenty of room.
I mean, I think we are to a point where, like, people, if they want to know, like, should I see this movie, they might be more likely to ask their friends sometime. But at the same time, when it comes down to it, when you want to see what movies are going to win an Oscar, you know, your friend might not know that, but a critic would know that. So it's sort of a difference between like the posterity and like your personal fun this weekend. You know, it's like that might be something you rely on your friend or Yelp or any of the other places you could go. But when it comes down to how will we look at this artist in history, or how will we remember this film, or who will win the award, that's what we need arts journalists and critics for.
Well, and before we wrap up here, I did want to ask you about what you're working on this week. This is inauguration week is when we're recording this. The inauguration is a couple of days away, and I understand that you're sort of going to be involved in some of the post coverage of that.
This weekend it's madness. It's
what do you got for madness. It? And Megan, you as well are going to be covering some
inauguration
stuff.
I am going to non-official and possibly official balls.
Which ones?
Green Ball, Starry Night.
I went to that last time. 4 years ago, I went to the Green Ball.
Oh.
It was fun. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it, and especially finding the story that I hope is going to hit me when I'm there, because I don't want to do, like you said, a traditional, you know, this is what people were wearing.
This is our peek into Washington journalism. This is every 4 years we get to have a big party.
But every year we also have the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Oh, that's right.
So that's the other journalist party.
Gosh, Michael, how could you forget?
that's always fun to cover, too. This year, or this weekend, I'm covering 4 inaugural balls, and also 1 like party during the day. And sort of the way the Post has done our inauguration coverage is we've kind of like mobilized tons of people to just be out and about and reporting back from parties and feeding the grid. I don't know if you guys know the grid, which we used a lot during election night. It's kind of this... Like Instagram and video and all kinds of other things will feed into the grid. And so that's what our job is. That's my job for the whole weekend, is just to like find things to feed the grid, which like makes it sound like this terrible monster.
But, it's the Matrix.
Yeah. So I'll be out taking Instagrams and tweeting and also just filing small reports that will go into a larger story that someone else will be in the office compiling too. Mm. So tonight I'm going to 2 inauguration parties that are not balls. And then Sunday I'm going to the hip hop ball and the peace ball. And then Monday I'm going to a watch party at the Canadian Embassy. And then I'm going to the official inaugural ball. And then I'm going to the HRC, the Human Rights ball.
Wow.
Well, definitely be interesting, especially because, you know, you're getting almost the same story from multiple different perspectives.
Yeah, yeah. I was talking to a lot of coworkers who have been covering inaugural balls for like, you know, 15 years, like the reliable source columnists, and they like they seem so over it. Whereas like I'm still like, oh, I'm cool. I'm going to inaugural ball. I have my pass. I have like my, you know, security clearance and everything. But they're like, you know. So I mean, I think our sort of thing that we're going to be doing is trying to get stories that are sort of like overheard moments or kind of things that are unique to each ball. Because like you said, I mean, all these balls really are kind of the same. It's just a difference between which celebrities are there and like what people are wearing. So you have to look for the kind of the interesting moments and the moments that are unique to the ball and sort of explain the ball and explain Washington at the same time. That's like the best part, is when you find someone who's saying that one perfect quote that explains the entire night. So that's what I'll be looking for.
Interesting. I was talking to a TOP reporter, and she was saying, she talked about covering the inauguration in the past and going and covering some of the balls, but she said that one of the fun times for her was the morning after, going down to Chinatown and interviewing people who were on the street in their formal gowns, you know, from the night before, talking about the whole experience.
Oh, yeah, that's a great idea, actually. See, we were actually told that one of the best places to catch people is coat check lines, because you're like, they're prisoners. So they're like captive.
Waiting,
you know, if they're stuck with a reporter, because they're not going to get out of that line, because that line is long. So I might ambush someone.
And they're going to be needing their coats.
Yeah. It's really going to be cold.
Well, thank you for coming in, Mara. This is really interesting.
Where can people
follow you on Twitter?
Oh, it's just my full name, Mara Judkiss, and same with Instagram.
All right. I'm Michael O'Connell with Megan Clougherty. We've been talking to Mara Judkiss of The Washington Post. And thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of the media. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about us at itsalljournalism.com. We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, Email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com. Also look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @AllJournalism.